Good morning and welcome to this week's programme. The first in a short series to mark the life and contribution to Irish music of piper, storyteller, collector Seamus Ennis, who died just 20 years ago. In this morning's programme, his roots in North County Dublin, his musical background, his father's influence on him, his work with the Irish Folklore Commission, and his recruitment to Radio Éireann in 1947, Sean McRaymon remembers their early work together. Early next month will mark the 20th anniversary of the death of one of the most remarkable Irishmen of his generation, Seamus Ennis.
He was, of course, the sort of man who is blessed or cursed by having legends attached to him and having and being treated perhaps more as a character than as one who has done something solid. The same is true of a whole host of Irish people too. In our time, Paddy Kavanagh, Brendan Behan, Miles O'Loughlin, and one tends perhaps to overlook their own achievements in comparison with their character status. Now, the character status sometimes is a defense mechanism, as you know, but sometimes it represents the way in which perhaps society resents the artist. And often spoke of Seamus Ennis as if his whole life was devoted to roistering on the place, you say, without reference to the very solid work he did, and to, as I said, his great talent amounting to genius as a performer.
It was on a Sunday morning after Mass in Carna, down in their 40s, mid-40s, I think, maybe 44 or 43, round about that time, and I saw this fine man standing outside, and he was introduced to him. And there started a chorus, a chorus that remained the day he died. So collecting folklore that time on the Folklore Commission. This is the job that suited him the best, because there was no clock.
Next, his daughter Catherine, whom he hadn't met since his marriage breakup, when she was just 4 years old. They next spoke on the telephone when she was an adult.
The lot fell on me, and I rang up and I said, "Hello, can I speak to Seamus Ennis?" And he said, "That's me." And I said, "Oh, hello." Very difficult. And I said, "This is your daughter. Remember me? I was the one, you know, who was four with a short hair." And it was very difficult to know what to say, but he was wonderful. He said, "I have a big lump in my throat, Catherine, and it's lovely to hear you." And I was all right from then on, really. But I had a feeling of slight resentment because he was so wonderful with children. You ever saw him with children? He created a magical world of his own and told stories, and he was completely devoted to them. In the time he was with them, he created mystery and fun and, just magic. And when I met him again, I slightly resented the fact that he deprived me of it. I know that was very selfish, but there was so that took a bit of getting over.
He had that old maestro thing that when he was holding court, and then people flocked out to hear him. He had that sort of pride, which is very justifiable, that he wasn't going to go into the middle of an existing crowd, that he would go out and say the word to a place, and then the word would come out that the master himself is going to play in such and such a house, which happened to be O'Connor's this night. And they did flock out indeed to hear this particular session.
This man who's, I suppose, in a lot of ways behaving like a very spoiled child, but I was so thrilled to be with him that I kind of got off on nurturing all this, you know. He wanted things like broiled chicken and fresh orange juice, and like Britvic would be no good. So we used to set out, I used to actually squeeze oranges in the flat and take them away then to the gig.
I think he had an absolutely distinctive tone. And when I first heard Seamus's playing, it was one of the things, at any rate, that really struck me, was this beautiful tone he got from the instrument. And it was, I think, most forcefully demonstrated to me when I asked him to play my pipes. He put the pipes on and played them, and there was the unmistakable Ennis tone.
Seamus Ennis was born in North County, Dublin, and he's buried there in Knowle. He told Páraic O'Rahilly in this interview that his ancestral roots were in Knowle.
It is, for I'd say I'm fourth generation there.
Your great grandfather.
I think so.
Your grandfather, your father.
My great grandfather.
And down to your.
And I believe, Páraic, an interesting thing, that he was a stable boy for a nobleman in Scotland.
This is your great-grandfather now?
Yes. Mm-hmm. He and the nobleman's daughter fell in love and eloped with her jewellery and bought this farm with her jewellery.
Came back from Scotland?
Yes.
And bought the farm with her jewellery, yes. And settled there?
Yes.
It's fourth generation now?
Yes.
The land you're living on, actually, is the ancestral land, isn't it?
It is, yes. My uncle sold it to a man in the locality, a farmer, Joe McNally. And Joe McNally gave me a plot on my grandfather's land for my mobile home.
He was born in May 1919. There was a tradition of music in his family.
Yes, my uncle and grandfather were both fiddlers. My father took up piping. Of course, he was a fiddler, flute player, war piper, and Dillon piper. And he started the Knowle Pipe Band, and they mingled later with the Lusk Pipers. There are still one or two old fiddlers in the district.
Was the traditional singing strong there?
No, it wouldn't appear to have been. I have several fragments from my grandfather through my father, which are essentially Scottish. Hence the stable boy, the proof of the stable boy yarn.
Yes. Yes.
Seamus Ennis's father had played on the opening night of this station, 2RN, and his father played in a group called the Fingal Trio. John Cawley was a member of the Fingal Trio, and here Seamus Ennis, in 1982, shortly before his death, is presenting a radio program, Call the Tune. He included music with family associations, and in the course of the program, in an anecdotal style, told much of his own life story.
John Cawley hailed from Ballymote country in County Sligo. Gentleman John Cawley, my mother and father called him. And I remember my mother mopping the floor after a music session at home because Mr. Cawley played the concert flute in unison with Mr. Frank O'Higgins on his big fiddle and my father's piping. They were, in fact, the Fingal Trio, practicing and preparing programs for frequent broadcasts in those days, about 45 years ago. Gentleman John Cawley, everyone remarked, was always dressed in an immaculately neat suit of clothes, very well groomed, complete with hat, and a neat white handkerchief in his breast pocket. I heard it said that he must have been in America, he dressed so well. But sure, times change. I remember him rubbing his fingers across his tongue before playing the flute to make for staunch stopping. He used to carry the flute in three pieces in his pocket, and years later, in the company of other instrumentalists, he'd produce it, saying, "I just happened to have it in my pocket since last night." Of course, we never laughed at that one in his presence. One Saturday afternoon, he arrived at my father's place, and my father was busy rubbing blackcurrant leaves on the inside of a straw skep, with a linen sheet ready in the orchard. One of our beehives had swarmed, and the swarm of bees clung to the branch of an apple tree. Greetings and a welcome were accorded to Mr. Cawley, and my father was excusing himself to put on the beekeeper's veil and gloves and so on when Mr. Cawley said, "Don't trouble yourself, hand me that skip." And as one might stroll on Broadway, he stepped up to the apple tree with the skep inverted in his right hand, thumped the branch with his left hand, ignoring the linen sheet for covering to keep the bees in, carried the swarm to where my father had a beehive base in readiness 20 yards away. If my father or I had attempted that, we would have been stung to death. "No," Mr. Cawley said, "they'd never sting me. Either they like or dislike the smell of a man or object to some unknown electrical ray in his makeup." We were astonished, but Mr. Cawley was as calm, smooth, and unruffled as his glorious flute playing. My father and I learned a stranger from Mr. Cawley. He had no name, so my father always called it Cawley's Reed, with its calm, smooth flow of melody.
The third member of the Fingal Trio was fiddler Frank O'Higgins.
With a droll sense of good humour. He was a native of Kells in County Meath and a stalwart survivor of a hardy hunger strike in the troubled times. And I'm told he was still able to command his fiddle to the end. I remember him being in our house frequently when he and my father went through their tunes together. I remember also one time my father took myself and my brother in his car on a tour of West Clare and Connemara. After our return, we rhymed a resume of our journeyings and posted it to him. His reply was in rhyme, with his characteristic wit, and one fragment still stays with me. "Men may rhyme and men may not, but I could rhyme forever. If e'er you're rambling round again, don't fail to see Ross Trevor." And that wasn't for his brother Brian's Christmas cards. One tune they were at one night was "The Dogs Among the Bushes," a great descriptive reel, a piper's reel, it seems. I remember my father asking him to try and get the yelping of the dogs effect into it, which seemed to present a difficulty on the fiddle. Like this. Imagine for yourself a man coming home late from conviviality to his neglected, hungry, yelping dogs and throwing out the remains of a leg of mutton to them, being faulty in his aiming and landing it among the bushes near the door. Then the neighbor's dogs, attracted by the yelping, join the party and making a Joe Marr out of it. I remember that and the way my father played "The Dog Among the Bushes."
Ennis's mother was also a musician, and again from the program he presented in 1982 called The Tune, here is a fragment of autobiography.
In memories, sometimes vivid and other times vague, one recalls childhood moments. In this instance, it's a vivid one. I recall when my father would be playing at home for pleasure for himself, for my mother, and only some of us then. My mother would be asking him to play certain tunes, the Heather Breeze, Dunphy's hornpipe, and others, but particularly a reel which he had, known by the old pipers as Lady Carberry. Calibre, I know now, is in Munster. My mother was a native of Monaghan, and when my father told her that the tune was also called Miss Monaghan, and Muinichon being a northern dialectical pronunciation of the diminutive of Muinichon, Munsterish, in appreciation of the warm welcomes of County Monaghan, she formed a sentimental attachment to the tune in addition to her pleasure in hearing it, even if it had no name. I've never heard anyone play it the way my father did. It differs so much from the common Cayley band and printed versions of it. To me, it's still Lady Carberry or Miss Monaghan, and I have it the way my mother liked it and my father played it to her. Ah, the years gone by make moist the eye. Here comes Lady Carberry now herself.
Seamus Ennis's first job was with publisher Colm O'Loughlin at the Three Candles Press.
I had done a civil service examination and I was waiting for the result, waiting for a call. As I remember it, 44 were called and I had 45th place. And I was waiting for the next call. Yeah. And I went into University College Dublin to see a pal of mine who was doing medicine. And I met Colm O'Loughlin, who was a lecturer there. And he asked me what was I doing, and I told him. He said, come into my place with Three Candles, and I'll give you a job that'll keep you going. Colm used to come to our house every Thursday night. He would give my father lessons in Irish, and my father would give him lessons in piping in exchange. I was doing a manuscript for the printer on the Clash of the Leaflets songs with the Irish words under the staff notation.
Colm O'Loughlin was looking out for young Seamus Ennis and knew of the ambitions of James DeLargy at the Irish Folklore Commission to collect traditional music. This was before mobile recording was possible. This was during the Second World War, the emergency, and Seamus Ennis's job was to travel the country writing down music and words.
He introduced me to Professor DeLargy of the Irish Folklore Commission, and I got a job there on my push bicycle to travel among the old people. My first journey was Connemara, and carry my manuscript paper and my pen with me and write down the tunes as they sang them. And it was £3 a week and no expenses. Wow. Imagine, Porrex, 30 shillings, that's £1.50 in today's money for your digs, and £1.50 then to buy your the other necessities. For instance, the plug of tobacco for the old man you'd be working with. Baby power, baby whiskey, maybe an agon to cheer him up. I remember writing a song on the side of the road between Ornmore and Galway. A song from a roadman, a man who was sweeping the road. The Gershlon war a shahodil mere. Ere holo de lapons near ere to me. Ere holmo lav harm leg boken de veil. That was the first verse I ever wrote down.
And James DeLargy was in turn looking out for Seamus Ennis. He alerted him to a new phase in broadcasting, the recruitment by Radio Éireann of what were known as outside broadcast officers. Seamus Ennis was working in Scotland at the time.
While I was out there in Scotland, Professor DeLargy wrote to me and told me that there was a vacancy for a mobile recording officer, and he'd advised me to apply for it because he didn't expect to have the finances to advance my position.
Recruited with Seamus Ennis was Sean McRaymon, and we listen next to part of Peter Brown's original field tape interview with Sean McRaymon talking about Seamus Ennis. This tape was later edited for Peter Brown's documentary, The Seamus Ennis Story, so much of what you hear next has not been broadcast before.
We had applied for a job called Outside Broadcasts Officer, and I won't bore you by going into the theology, as they say, of the subject, in that the one thing we never did were outside broadcasts. But, I mean, that's part of another story. In fact, what our job was, and I recall the terms of the job spec, to seek throughout the country, including the Gaeltacht, material suitable for recording and suitable broadcasting. Now, this was a big step forward in Irish broadcasting. Indeed, it hadn't been all that long a feature of broadcasting anywhere, particularly in those countries where broadcasting had been arrested by the war. We weren't, of course, but on the other hand, we had our emergency and we were cut off in various things. There was a great expansion of radio here in 1947, and we were one bit of that expansion. But the important thing was that previously, putting talent, as it were, putting the country, putting rural Ireland, putting provincial Ireland, I know all these phrases are loaded, putting all this on the air was a big deal. I mean, either you went down and had a full-blown broadcast, especially prepared broadcast, or people had to come to Dublin and they went through processes of rehearsal and studio and all that. This was literally bringing the mic to the people. And it was a new thing. It was an immense education for those of us who were involved in it, of course. But it was also, I think, it really did widen the horizons of broadcasting and widen, too, perhaps, in some way, we can claim, I think, that modesty, it widened the horizons of the people with whom the mobile recording unit, as it's called, came in contact. Now, of course, one aspect of this whole thing was the living folk tradition of Ireland, about which more... perhaps there were more pious platitudes than there were actual good deeds done in those days. With, of course, the great and very honourable exception of the Irish Folklore Commission, which had, on very tiny resources, done an immense job of recording and cataloguing, of their own phrase, gathering the fragments. And Seamus Ennis had been part of that enterprise before he came to us. He had worked, in other words, in the field. He had collected folk songs. He'd collected traditional music. I suppose all over Ireland, in the Gaeltacht, outside the Gaeltacht. And talking about Gaeltacht, he also did it in Scotland, in the Scottish Gaeltacht, where there was a joint project, I think, with the Folklore Institute of Scotland, which is part of the Board of Scottish Studies. I may have that wrong, but that was... And he made great contact there. Now, one of the things that was I remember from that time was that I was astonished, of course, that wherever I went with Seamus, in the Gaeltacht, he seemed to take on the accent... and the act, in every sense of that word, and the approach in speech, the intonation, the idiom, the way of looking at things of the particular area he was in, with the result that one thought of him as a a native speaker from County Kerry or County Cork, if you were in County Kerry or County Cork. Similarly, in Galway, in Mayo, in Donegal. But what I was very interested and amused to hear later was that the same thing was true in Scotland. Now, with this slight difference, in the island of Skye, for instance, they believed that he'd come perhaps from one of the more northern islands, you see. And in Skye, or in South Uist, they might believe he came from Skye. But again, there, he had not alone mastered Scots Gaelic, but he had made it his own in a very real sense. And that, I think, was perhaps the kernel of his genius. That in the whole range of the folk world, he had a capacity for, I would say, the almost instant transmutation of what came to him and making it his own without distorting it. Now, it wasn't clever mimicry. I have heard people who can mimic a traditional singer, say. And, I mean, we've all suffered the bad ones, the things who think that they put the nya in it and all that. But we've heard clever ones, too. But Seamus wasn't just that. It wasn't just catching the intonation. It, by some magic, he was the singer from that area. And may I say that Seamus had the most uncanny, as well as this capacity for, as I say, appropriating and, as it were, renewing and giving out again, this recreating, in fact, what he heard. He also had an extraordinarily sharp ear, an unbelievably sharp ear. Of course, that was part of it. But also, not just the ear for accurate reproduction, but the ear for detecting the authentic from the phony. And that is a very necessary part of the equipment of any man who's doing field work in this area.
This morning's program was based on original programs by Peter Brown, Kieran McMahona, Porrick O'Rahilly, Julian Bilnells, and Seamus Ennis himself. More on Seamus Ennis to mark the 20th anniversary of his death, the same time on Saturday morning next. Thank you for listening this morning, and good morning.
The program was presented and produced by John Bowman.